And I think the last trip that I took before COVID shut us all down was to come up to Rutland. My wife and I came up to Rutland and I preached for you last February. So you may or may not remember that, but it's nice to be back. I'm going to begin with a poem by the poet Mary Oliver. And this poem is called Messenger. And she writes, "My work is loving the world. Here the sunflowers, there the hummingbirds, here the quickening yeast, there the blue plums, here the clam deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I no longer young or still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. Learning to be astonished, the Phoebe, the delphinium, the sheep in the pasture, and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing since all the ingredients are here, which is gratitude to be given a mind and a heart and these body clothes, a mouth with which to give shouts of joy to the moth and the wren, to the sleepy dug-up clam, telling them all over and over how it is that we live forever." Unitarian Universalist preachers face a challenge that is not shared by most other ministers or religious leaders, and that is the challenge of multiplicity. On a typical Sunday morning in the congregations I've served, when I rose to speak, I would look out on an assembly that would likely include a number of people who grew up and left Catholicism, a few people who either practiced or leaned towards Buddhism. There'd be a handful of atheists, some hard-bitten evangelical come-outers. There'd be a couple of Christians and a clutch of faithful who had actually been raised as Unitarian Universalists. And then a group that really didn't care that much, but really liked the music and the coffee hour. Now, other clergy don't face this same challenge. A Methodist minister will most likely be looking at Methodists in the pew, and a Presbyterian, Presbyterians, a Catholic priest is looking out at Catholics. Now, of course, every clergy person who gets up to speak their faith is facing challenges of one sort or another, not just the challenge of finding common ground among such a wide range of experiences. But that said, here's a bit of our history. I want to go give you a little bit of our history. Many of you will already be familiar with this. The Universalist Church of America and the American Unitarian Association merged in 1961 to form the Unitarian Universalist Association. But both groups trace their beginnings to the late 1700s. There were Universalist congregations forming at the time of the American Revolution. The Unitarians were not far behind. The Universalists formed in reaction to the doctrine of predestination, which held that before you were even born, God knew whether you would end up in heaven or hell. The Universalists believed that the Bible described a loving God, and they began to preach a gospel that proclaimed that a loving God would not create a human being just to damn her to hell for all eternity. So the Universalists preached that all men, all women would be saved. All humankind would universally be returned to God. And while this may not seem like such an outrageous claim in this day and age, at the time, Universalist preaching brought widespread condemnation and even evoked mobs and violence. The Unitarians, on the other hand, observed that the idea of the Trinity, which asserts Father, Son, Holy Ghost, are at the same time one and three. And furthermore, the doctrine of the Trinity asserts that Jesus is both all human, all God, all the time. So based on their study of the Bible, the Unitarians preach that there exists a unity. God is not three, but one. And that Jesus, the man, was a man and not God. A footnote here is that both Universalist and Unitarian theologies Both the Unitarian Universalist and Unitarian theological positions had been present and generally condemned over the centuries since Christianity arose. Still at the time, despite claims which would have marked them as heretics for most of Western history, in the 19th century, both of our groups were referred to as the liberal Christians. Now, as they challenged the prevailing theology of the day, the groups shared common ground. There was some degree of cooperation between the denominations, and many ministers served both Unitarian and Universalist congregations over their careers. But there were important distinctions between the groups, and the most influential difference was class. Unitarianism grew out of the academic, the established class. The Universalists spread through the middle class, merchants, farmers, smaller towns. It was commonly observed that on the one hand, Universalists believed that God was too good to damn them, and that on the other hand, the Unitarians believed that they were too good to be damned. What's important this morning is that the earliest iterations of our history were grounded in the Judeo-Christian tradition, even if they were a bit off kilter. But two events shook that ground and helped to shape who we are now. The first of those was the publication of 1869 of Darwin's book, The Origin of Species. I'm sure that you're all familiar with the contemporary battles over the theory of evolution, but it's nearly impossible to overstate the shockwaves that reverberated through religious circles at the publication of Darwin's Origins of Species. Think of the last book or movie or television drama that caught everyone's attention and was the occasion of controversy at dinner parties or coffee hours or family gatherings. You may recall such an event or a book, but now imagine that the conversation continues for 150 years. Conservatives are still denying attacking evolution 152 years later. What is important is that in the years following, the publication Darwin's theories pushed religious liberals and moderates, including the Unitarians and the Universalists, further and further into a scientific worldview. Religious conservatives were right to be enraged post-Darwin. Out goes the authority of the Bible. Pushed aside are the Christian creation myths. The stories of Jesus performing miracles and raising the dead become, well, stories. And the idea of an all-knowing, all-powerful, all-perfect God was undermined. Unitarian and Universalist thought was not transformed overnight, but the seeds were sown, and the liberal fringes of both traditions expanded. A broader religious imagination came into play. A more serious exploration of world religions began. The centrality of the Christian story weakened. Even the idea of God came into question, which led to the second event that I want to mention, which was the publication in 1933 of a document called the Humanist Manifesto, written by a Unitarian minister, signed by Unitarian and Universalist clergy, as well as philosophers and humanist leaders. This document's the foundation and a forerunner of what we claim as our principles and purposes. Wikipedia sums it up this way. The document outlines affirmations on cosmology, biology, human nature, epistemology, ethics, religion, and the quest for social justice. Sounds a lot like us. Well, truth be told, it is us. I'd invite you to check out the Humanist Manifesto for yourself if you've never done so. There's an excellent write-up on Wikipedia. It's a clarifying document for us as Unitarian Universalists. Among other things, it says that religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing and not created. And that humanism believes that we are a part of nature and that we emerged as a result of a continuing process. And also it says humanism asserts that the nature of the universe depicted by modern science makes unacceptable any supernatural or cosmic guarantees of human values. Plus religion, it says, consists of those actions. Religion is, are those actions, purposes, experiences, which are humanly significant. Nothing human is alien to religion. And the distinction between the sacred and the secular can no longer be maintained. The goal of humanism is a free and universal society in which people voluntarily cooperate for the common good. Okay, so the publication of the Humanist Manifesto is also a moment that helps shape who we are as Unitarian Universalists almost 90 years later. If you should see the Humanist Manifesto alongside our principles and purposes, I think the connections will be easily apparent to you. So getting back to my sermon title, which is spiritual but not religious, for years, I've been listening to people say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. So it may seem odd to wander off into EU history, but it makes sense. To talk about spirituality, we have to consider what we mean by spirituality. Now, in the past, an interest in or an experience of spirituality would have meant developing some relationship or some sense of connection to God, as God was understood in the Christian world. I think it's fair to say that it used to be that when people wanted to deepen their spiritual lives, they sought out the church. They didn't stay away from it. But that's changed for many people. What do people mean by spiritual? Now, the dictionary says religious, sacred, divine, holy, churchly. And it also says non-material, inner, intangible, ethereal, transcendent, numinous, extra mundane. Now, this is probably closer to what people mean when they say that they're spiritual, but not religious. And when I hear people say that they are spiritual, I assume that they are open to and value experiences that feel transcendent, that feel numinous or mystical or intangible. And I also assume that they are hungry for experiences that, as the dictionary describes it, are extra mundane. That is, moments that lift us up above the mundane, that lift us up above our day-to-day experience and connect us to something that feels larger than what seem to be the edges of our own lives. And in my experience, there are many things that have the capacity to lift us and expand our horizons. Art, theater, beauty, nature, music, the stars, the ocean, love, meditation, grandchildren, pretty much any poem by Mary Oliver. So whenever I hear someone say that they are spiritual, I assume that they seek out such experiences. And when I hear them say that they are not religious, I assume that they have not found such experiences in the context of a church or a congregation, which is too bad, because certainly a sense of being lifted above the day-to-day, a sense of the numinous, a sense of connection to something extra mundane, is for many of us a welcome part of our experience in congregations. And thank goodness for that. Certainly, there is a spiritual aspect to our lives in congregations, and thank goodness for that. And here is one of the things I really want to say this morning. Spirituality is not what we do best, and maybe not even the most important thing that we do. Should I say that again? Spirituality is not what we do best, and maybe not even the most important thing that we do. Don't get me wrong. Spirituality is an important part of our congregational life, and our worship together should set in place the elements that invite people to feel uplifted and connected to something larger than themselves. But spiritual expertise is not our cup of tea. We don't teach a spiritual discipline. We do not have a formula or an inside track to enlightenment or heaven or transcendence. We do not claim to know how to be spiritual, how to know the right way to breathe. We don't have a script with words that need to be spoken in a set order for the spirituality to come out. Spirituality is not our strong suit. When someone tells me that they are spiritual but not religious, I always want to reply that push come to shove, I'm religious but not spiritual. What I believe in and what I have spent my life working for is congregations and congregational life. And by this, of course, I mean healthy, positive, open, thriving congregations, not congregations that preach hate, not congregations that are unwelcoming to strangers or ideas, not congregations that refuse to change, not congregations that preach that Jesus just wants everybody to get rich, so everyone should send in their money. There are a lot of unhealthy congregations in the world, and I understand why people would want to stay away from them. I want to stay away from them. But there are a lot of wonderful, thriving congregations in the world as well. But, and here is what I have to say this morning, the central point of my sermon this morning. I've come all the way to Rockland to talk to you. Oh, no, wait, I'm still at my office desk in Brattleboro. Never mind. Here's my point. Religious congregations are one of the most powerful, miraculous institutions that we have ever thought of. When it comes to learning how to be decent human beings, a healthy congregation can be a godsend, so to speak. Let me tell you what I mean. Here are some of the things that happen in healthy and thriving congregations. Congregations save lives. Are any of you familiar with Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone? I hope so. It's a great book. Putnam talks about social capital and its importance in the health of individuals and the health of communities. We are social creatures. Our need for human connection is embedded in our genes. There's probably a whole sermon series in this book, but just let me give you one example. Putnam points to research that shows that if a person should have a lung removed due to lung cancer, in recovery, that person will live longer if he or she is connected to other caring people in a place like a church than if he or she stops smoking. Get that? You have a lung removed, you'll live longer if you're connected to a group of caring people, such as a church, than if you stop the smoking. Another example. I was at a political hearing a few years ago, and a woman at a display table waved at me to get my attention. I could not place her. She looked like someone who looked like someone I should know. But I went over and she said to me, "I want to thank you. You saved my life." "I did," I said. But she said, "Yes. You may not remember, but 2 years ago, I decided to take my own life. It was Sunday morning. I was headed to the river when I drove past your church. I decided to go in, and you were so warm and friendly and welcoming that I decided to think it over. So here I am. Thank you." Well, I can't take credit for saving her life, but I will take credit for helping a congregation be so warm and engaging and welcoming that someone would feel the pulse of life and decide to reconsider. And our congregations not only save lives, congregations help heal the broken. Over the years of ministry, I've watched time and again some bedraggled soul worn by care or anxiety tentatively cross our threshold, stay through coffee hour, venture back the next week, and the next, and the next. And then maybe 4 years later, take their turn serving on the board, energize some committee, become the person who greets the next bedraggled soul seeking us out. Do any of you know the song Song of the Myra? Anybody familiar with the song Song of the Myra? It's a song about about community, and my wife and I sing it from time to time. Our favorite line is this one. It says, "And if you're broken, they'll see that you mend. I'm going to be with them again." Our congregations help people mend. It's part of what we do. And furthermore, when we gather in congregations, we can help to change the world. One of the most important movements of the 20th century was the American Civil Rights Movement. It changed the landscape, and the sobering fact that that work is not done, that racism is still an ugly presence in our common life, should not blind us to what was accomplished. It was important to remember that the foundation and the driving force of the civil rights movement in this country was churches and congregations. Congregations have played a part in all of the notable reforms in the American story. Abolition, women's rights, civil rights, anti-war, social justice, climate change, LGBTQ. If you read history, you'll see that congregations were there. In congregations, we're called to remember our best selves. In congregations, we're called to remember our best selves. In a good and thriving congregation, we are called to be the best versions of ourselves, to be more loving, to be more caring, to be more connected, to be more engaged. Precipitation in a congregation requires that we strengthen our most positive human capacities: love, forbearance, generosity, charity, openness, gratitude, a broader vision, humility. Congregations enlarge our spirits. Participation in a congregation is a way to enlarge our imaginations, extend our horizon, grow our spirits. In a healthy congregation, we enjoy the opportunity to expand our horizons, to see ourselves as part of a wide and astonishing world, to learn new things, to see greater connections, to encounter new ideas. That's a good thing. It's a good thing. I could go on. There's much more that I think that we do, but let me just mention this one more. Congregations give us a chance to sing. Think about it. Singing may be as essential to human life as breathing. But for the most part, in the world we live in, we are sung too. Where else do you get to sing? No auditions necessary, nobody evaluating your performance. Everyone is invited to sing. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. And now, of course, a note of caution. Congregational life isn't easy. It takes work. It takes forbearance. It takes patience. It takes forgiveness. Sometimes when I talk with someone who says they are spiritual but not religious, it turns out that what they are avoiding is the messiness of congregational life. Well, I understand that. I've spent most of my working years engaged with the messiness of congregational life. It's hard work. But I believe it is worth doing now as much as ever. I purposely not connected this sermon to current events or to the present moment. We've all been too solidly connected to the present moment, I think, but I will connect it here in closing, because we're emerging from multiple soul catastrophes. We have endured probably the worst 4 years of American government in history. We've endured a life-altering panic. We've endured an economic disaster. We've endured the renewed awareness of the challenge of a racist world. It has been nonstop. Now is not the time to step back or to falter. We need each other. We need the comfort and the strength of congregational life. We need the promise of a liberal church. And remember this, our communities need us. I'm not actually particularly spiritual, but I am wholeheartedly and enduringly religious. Thank you.